All right. Welcome in, everyone, to the deep dive. We've got a real legal head scratcher for you today.
Oh, yeah.
A case that kind of reads like one of those, you know, legal thrillers.
Oh, well, I'm intrigued. Lay it on me.
United States versus Della Rose. Attorney at the center of it all. A fake ID floating around. Seems like an open and shut case, right?
Yeah.
But then things get interesting.
Okay, I'm listening. What kind of twist are we talking about here?
So Della Rose, he gets convicted on mail fraud. That part's upheld, no problem. But the conviction for conspiracy to produce that fake ID, that gets tossed out.
Whoa. Now that's interesting. Two charges, seemingly connected, but one sticks and the other doesn't. That's prime deep dive material right there.
Exactly. And for anyone out there, you know, really getting into federal criminal law, this case is like a masterclass in nuance.
Yeah, big time.
So the million-dollar question we're going to tackle today, why did one charge hold up while the other fell apart? And to really get into the weeds on this one, we've been poring over the actual court documents.
Oh, nice. Primary sources.
Absolutely. Plus, we've got some great guidance specifically put together for us here at Lex Bluck Luck. So our mission, if you choose to accept it, understand the ins and outs of federal criminal law, especially this whole concept of interstate commerce.
Sounds like a plan.
And we're going to do it all through the lens of this, frankly, really fascinating case.
All right, let's dive in. Where do we start?
Well, I think it makes sense to start with that mail fraud conviction, the one that stuck.
Yeah.
What exactly are we dealing with there?
Okay, so the charge itself is mail fraud, straight out of 18 U.S. Code, section 1341. Now, the thing about this charge, the thing that makes it kind of unique, is that the core element the prosecution has to nail down is using the good old U.S. Postal Service to pull off a scheme.
Even just using the mail as part of some kind of fraudulent plan, that's enough to trigger this.
You got it. Which is why this case is such a great teaching tool. It shows how these little details, these things we might not think twice about, can have huge implications in federal court.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So in Della Rose's case, what was the scheme? Embezzlement, plain and simple. We're talking about $64,000 in settlement funds that were supposed to go to his client.
Hold on, $64,000. That's not chump change. Who is this client that he ripped off?
Yeah, no kidding. The client's name was James George. And this is where the mail part really comes into play.
Okay, so how did the mail factor into all this?
The settlement check itself, the very money Della Rose was accused of pocketing, you know how it got to him, through the mail, and it's likely other key documents tied to the settlement they were mailed to.
Interesting. So that satisfied what they call the mailing element of the law.
Bingo. And here's a takeaway for all you aspiring legal eagles out there. Something as simple as using the mail, if it helps along a fraud, bam, you've got yourself a federal case.
It's kind of wild, right? I mean, we all use the mail all the time. To think that something so ordinary could be the difference between a local case and a federal one, it's a bit mind-blowing.
For sure. So that's the mail fraud conviction. Open and shut, as they say. Now let's flip over to the other side of the coin. The conspiracy to produce a false ID. The charge that didn't stick.
Yeah, that's the part I'm really curious about. Because on the surface, it seems like a pretty clear connection. Fake ID used in a fraud seems pretty federal to me.
You'd think, right? But this is where things get super specific, and we need to look closely at what the law actually requires. We're talking about 18 U.S.C. sections 1028 and 371 here, and the big catch is this. To make this a federal crime, they've got to prove that the production of the fake ID itself was tied to interstate commerce. Not just that it was used in a crime that involved interstate commerce, but that the actual making of the ID crossed state lines or impacted interstate commerce in some way.
That's a subtle but important distinction.
It is, and it's exactly what tripped up the prosecution in this case.
All right, so let's get into the nitty-gritty of this fake ID. Who was involved, and how did it all go down?
So we've got Della Rose, of course, and then two other guys enter the picture, Ilenfeld, and then this guy Romanski, who, get this, worked at the Illinois Secretary of State's office. Their plan. Cook up a phony Illinois ID, Ilenfeld's mugshot on it, but with James George's name, you know, the client.
So they made this fake ID, and I'm guessing the prosecution presented evidence that Ilenfeld used it to cash that settlement check, right?
You got it. And they did it at a Bank One branch right there in Chicago. Seems like a pretty straightforward link between the fake ID and the fraud, right? You'd think that would be enough to satisfy the interstate commerce requirement?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, a bank cashing checks, that's got to be tied to interstate commerce somehow.
Well, here's the thing. The court said, hold on a sec. They made a very clear point. The law zeroes in on the production of the ID, not just its use. And the government, they didn't bring the receipts to prove that Bank One's business involved interstate commerce.
Wait, so just because Eilenfeld used the ID at a bank, that wasn't enough to prove the bank itself was involved in interstate commerce?
Nope. Not in the eyes of the court. They needed more. They needed to show, for example, that Bank One had branches in multiple states, or that its transactions regularly crossed state lines, or even that the Secretary of State's office, where the ID was supposedly cooked up, got their materials for making IDs from out of state. They didn't show any of that.
Wow. So even though the fake ID was used in this whole financial scheme, they didn't connect the dots all the way back to the creation of the ID itself and show how that specific act was tied to interstate commerce.
You nailed it. And the court basically said, look, we can't just assume things. They even laid down a pretty important quote. Neither the jury nor the court is entitled to assume facts not in evidence.
Boom. Mic drop moment right there. That quote really highlights how crucial specific evidence is in a case like this.
Exactly. So what's the lesson here for our listeners, especially those in law school? Federal jurisdiction, in criminal cases at least, it's not a slam dunk. They've got to prove that interstate connection every single time if the law requires it.
This case is really showing us just how carefully crafted those federal laws are. All right, let's switch gears a bit and talk about something that always fascinates me. The evidence. In this case, we had some testimony allowed in, some kept out. Why was that?
Oh, yeah, the evidence game is always interesting. The testimony of Richard Britz, that's a great example. He told the court about a previous scheme Dela Rose was involved in, also involving fake IDs, also with Romanski back in the mix. And this was like mid-90s, so pretty old news.
Hang on, they let him talk about something Dela Rose did years ago. Isn't there a rule against that?
Right. Usually you can't bring up someone's past bad acts to imply they did it again. But there's this thing called Rule 404B. It's part of the federal rules of evidence. And it says that sometimes you can use past bad acts as evidence.
When is it allowed?
Well, it can be used to prove things like motive or intent or even a pattern of behavior. In this case, the court said Britz's testimony was fair game because it showed a pattern with Dela Rose. He had done this whole fake ID thing before, with the same guy even. It painted a picture of intent and motive.
So it wasn't just saying, he's done bad stuff before, so he must have done it again. It was more nuanced than that.
Way more nuanced. They were using it to understand the specifics of this scheme. For you listeners out there, that distinction is super important. And now, here's the flip side. There was this guy, Frank DeFrancesco, whose testimony they didn't allow.
Okay, why not? What did he have to say?
Well, his testimony was all about Eilenfeld, the guy with his picture on the fake ID. DeFrancesco was going to claim that Eilenfeld had pulled other shady stuff in the past. But the court shut that down hard. They said it was hearsay.
Hearsay. So basically, DeFrancesco wasn't speaking from direct knowledge, right? Just stuff he'd heard from others.
Exactly. And the court's like, we can't rely on that. Plus, they said it wasn't even relevant to the charges against Dela Rose. They were trying to pin this on Dela Rose, not Eilenfeld's past.
So even though it was juicy gossip, it didn't directly connect to Dela Rose or the specific crimes he was charged with.
You got it. This whole thing really shows how those rules of evidence act like a filter. It's not a free-for-all throwing out any random piece of info. It's got to be reliable, relevant, and meet all those legal standards.
That's like a legal game of Clue. Got to have the right evidence to solve the case. Speaking of solving the case, let's talk about Dela Rose's sentence. He was initially hit with 41 months, right?
That's right. And that was on the higher end of what the sentencing guidelines allowed for back then.
Ah, the sentencing guidelines. A whole other can of worms. What was the sentencing landscape like back when Dela Rose got sentenced?
Okay, so pre-2005, before the Booker case came along, the federal sentencing guidelines, they were the Bible. Judges pretty much had to stick to those ranges unless there were very specific reasons to deviate.
Okay. And Booker changed all that, right? Made them advisory instead of mandatory.
You got it. Big Supreme Court decision. United States v. Booker. They said forcing judges to strictly follow the guidelines, it stepped on the Sixth Amendment's right to a jury trial. So, post-Booker, judges still got to consider the guidelines, but they have more wiggle room.
Fascinating. So did that change Dela Rose's sentence at all?
Nope, it didn't. Even after Booker came down, they reviewed his case and the judge said, even with more flexibility, I'd still give him those 41 months.
Wow. So even with the shift in how sentencing works, they stuck to the original punishment. That really shows you how seriously they took this case.
Absolutely. The judge clearly felt that sentence was appropriate, regardless of whether the guidelines were mandatory or just a guide.
This has been a deep dive in the truest sense of the word. So much to unpack here. But if we had to boil it down, what are the big takeaways for our listeners, especially the law students tuning in?
Okay, so first off, statutory elements. You got to know them inside and out, especially when it comes to federal criminal law. And pay close attention to that interstate commerce requirement. Don't just assume it's there. The prosecution has to prove it, without a doubt.
And that burden of proof, that's huge across all criminal cases. Every element of the crime got to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. Assumptions don't cut it in a federal court.
Nope, they sure don't. Another key takeaway, know the difference between making a fake ID and using it. Federal law, Section 1028, it's all about the production being tied to interstate commerce. That's a crucial distinction to grasp.
And as we saw, the rules of evidence are a powerful force in court. Understanding how things like Rule 404B and hearsay work, that's fundamental to understanding how legal cases play out.
Couldn't agree more. And finally, never forget the impact of Booker. The sentencing guidelines might be advisory now, but they're still a huge part of the process. Judges have more leeway, but the guidelines still carry a lot of weight.
Right. It's a balancing act. And understanding that balance is crucial for anyone wanting to work in federal law.
You said it.
So, United States v. Dela Rose, a case that reminds us that federal criminal law is all about precision. Got to have the right elements, the right evidence, all connecting in just the right way.
Couldn't have said it better myself. But here's a final thought to chew on. What if the government had done their homework? What if they had that tiny bit of evidence about Bank One or the Secretary of State's office and interstate commerce? Would the whole case have gone down differently? It makes you think, doesn't it? How those little details, the things that seem minor at first, can have a huge ripple effect on the outcome of a case.
Absolutely fascinating.
Uh-huh.
And for all of you listening, I'd encourage you to keep exploring. Check out other cases about interstate commerce, dig into different federal fraud statutes. There's a whole world of legal intricacies out there just waiting to be discovered. Thanks for joining us on the Deep Dive.
You bet.
Until next time.